When you look at Zelensky's visit to the United States, and how do you evaluate the outcome of this visit? And do you think that Zelensky is getting the support that he asked for?
Zelensky is a failed leader of a failed state, and he's not getting the support that he asked for. He's getting the crumbs. He came up with a desperate plan, the Zelensky peace plan, which is little more than it's called Ukraine wins. And the victory of Ukraine is contingent upon the defeat, strategic defeat of Russia. And so he says, in order for Ukraine to win, to regain its territory, Russia must be defeated. In order to defeat Russia, Ukraine needs certain assistance from the West. It's pie in the sky stuff. Again, I think we alluded to earlier that Israel, I mean not Israel, that Europe is collapsing economically. There's just no way Israel or Europe is in a position to provide the support that Zelensky claims to. It ultimately comes down to the United States. And again, right now, look, some people, have said it's comparing apples and oranges. You can't make comparison, but we just had a hurricane sweep through Appalachia and their entire community, cities that are gone. It doesn't resonate well with the American people that we just sent, seven point some odd billions of dollars to Ukraine and eight some odd billions of dollars to Israel without question, just did it. And yet we're struggling to come up with the aid to these hurricane-stricken places. It doesn't resonate well with America that we're giving away all this money to wars that have no, we don't get anything from these wars. They, and it makes us weaker, actually. It hurts us. If you don't understand how much Israel has hurt America in the last year, then you aren't looking at the global picture. We are becoming more and more isolated at a time when we're in this. Again, I use this term a lot, but it's a true term, an existential struggle between the rules-based international order and the law-based multipolar order that Russia and China have been trying to put together since February of 2022, when Xi Jinping and Putin met in Beijing and issued a 5,000-word joint statement. This is a big deal. And in order to, give ourselves a fighting chance, we need to engage with the global South. We need to win them over. We need hesitancy on the part of the global South about the promise of BRICS. What Israel has done is destroyed American credibility around the world. And so when we start talking about people rallying around American democracy, people are saying, no, we sort of like this BRICS thing. And we've lost it. This is because of Israel. It's because of the United States ultimately, but we could have at least had a fighting chance. We could have delayed the inevitable. We could have come up with a better plan. We have ignored BRICS so much. I mean, it's barely registering here in the West, barely registering. But the world is about to change. If Russia pulls off what Russia is trying to pull off, and they've had nearly 200, what I call mini ministerials between the time they took the presidency of BRICS in January up until the lead up of this. This means that they're bringing together panels of political experts, economic experts, et cetera, to meet to staff the various issues that need to be resolved to create the structures necessary to turn the theory of BRICS into reality. Russia is about to turn BRICS into a grown-up organization with institutions. If Russia pulls this off, BRICS will emerge from Kazan with institutions that enable it to better coordinate the consensus-driven decision-making that is necessary in a multipolar environment. It looks like Russia is going to pull this off. And if that happens, the global South is going to be sucked into that vortex. And America is going to be sitting there going, whoa, what happened? It's us in Europe, and Europe's a sinking ship. It's us in Japan, they're a sinking ship too. I mean, I'm starting to pay a little bit more attention to the Japanese economy, which apparently isn't as healthy as everybody makes it out to be. And so we'll be the ones that are isolated. And a lot of that isolation comes from the global reaction to what's going on with Israel and America's, unwillingness to stand up and do the right thing for Israel. And so there's this resentment. The United States isn't going to tolerate a war with, a world war with Russia. And that's what Zelensky's asking for. We can't afford it right now. And the other thing is, it's very, it could go nuclear that quick. I mean, I'm not, sometimes I think Medvedev is just saying things, but he is the deputy of the National Security Council, former president, former prime minister. He just told the Baltic states, Article 5 doesn't protect you when a Russian nuclear bomb wipes you off the face of the earth. It may kick in, but you won't know it because you'll be dead. You'll be a wet spot on the planet, he said. Now, why is he saying this? Well, because he knows, he sits in, he knows what Russian nuclear doctrine is. He knows what will happen if NATO goes to war, if the Baltics were able to, ever dared act out what they claim. We will be the initial strike against Russia and any NATO. No, you'll disappear instantly. It doesn't take much to remove Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia from the face of the earth. This is the stupidity. And yet in the West, oh, Russia's bluffing, Russia's bluffing, Russia's bluffing. Well, you can say that until Russia isn't bluffing. Then it's too late. Is it really worth the risk? Is it really worth the call, the call bluff on this one? I mean, I could understand, playing Russian roulette. I mean, I really couldn't ever understand it. But if someone said, it's like out of the Deer Hunter, well, if I do this, I can escape from prison. Or if I pull the trigger on this, I can win $1 million and change my life. Okay, is your life that bad that you have to do that? Yes, I have no choice. Okay, right. But right now, the game of Russian roulette doesn't give us anything good. All it's going to do is kill us. And we're playing Russian roulette, frankly speaking, with a six-chambered revolver and there's six bullets in it, which means it's not Russian roulette, it's suicide. And that's what we're engaged in right now, an act of suicide. And we're not recognizing it as such. We aren't going, you cannot strategically defeat a nuclear power. The Soviet Union defeated itself. We didn't defeat it. The Soviet Union collapsed of its own volition. We actually weren't seeking it. If you go back and take a look at George H.W. Bush's speech in Kiev in the lead up to the collapse, it's called the Chicken Kiev speech. And basically, he went in there and he threw cold water on Ukraine's aspirations for independence because we were trying to manage. We didn't want the collapse of the Soviet Union. We were uncertain about what would happen. We had this nascent developing relationship with Gorbachev that we were trying to flesh out. There was a lot of hesitancy, uncertainty, but we weren't actively saying go, 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 because we didn't know what was going to come from it. It collapsed because Boris Yeltsin pulled Russia from the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. That changed the entire tax structure. That changed how monies were distributed. That changed the balance of power because Russia was always the largest republic of the Soviet republics. And when Russia declared independence from the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, it basically made the Communist Party of the Soviet Union a paper tiger, an empty shell with no power. And it gutted Gorbachev's ability to continue to rule as the president of the Soviet Union. Russia committed, the Soviet Union committed suicide. That's what happened. It wasn't a defeat. So there's people like that. Oh, no, well, the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons and it went away. We could do the same thing to Russia. Different, totally different thing. Russia ain't in danger of collapsing in on itself. In fact, Putin's re-election in March proves that. Russia's stronger economically than it's ever, stronger than we are, so not in terms of the size, but the health. Russia doesn't have a $36 trillion debt, I'll tell you that much. So Russia's got growth. Germany just announced there will be no growth next year. No growth, which tends to mean actually be depression, not a recession, depression in Germany. That's the end of the German economy. That's the end of the European Union. If German economy collapses, there is no viability of the European Union. This is the reality out there. And yet, NATO, the European Union, and the United States continue to embrace a strategic direction that says we want to strategically defeat Russia. You can't. And if you did, you'd die. Because if you ever strategically defeated Russia as a nuclear power, they would use their nuclear weapons to prevent their defeat. That's just the way it rocks, baby. And yet, that's what Ukraine wants. That's the direction they want to go. It's a suicide pill. It's an unrealistic policy. It's an irresponsible policy. And I think there's a growing recognition in the United States of that. But so much political capital has been put into propping up Ukraine, that we are, and this is what I believe the strategic decision has been made, they know Ukraine's lost the war. And they know that there's not much we can do to, you know, resolve that situation, salvage it. In fact, there's nothing we can do. So Ukraine's going to sink, and we're going to be seen throwing life preservers into the water. That's it. We're going to say we did everything we could to help, and we were there to save them in the end, but that ship's going down with the crew, with the captain, it's gone. And that's the reality. Ukraine is gone. It's not going to survive this winter. Whatever comes out rolling into the spring is going to have to unconditionally surrender to Russia. That's the reality. If they survive now, I mean, the Russians are in the process of destroying the Ukrainian military on the battlefield.
And when part of this equation in Ukraine is the situation of Zelensky administration. And since this conflict started, we have Zelensky getting out, the foreign minister getting out, and right now the head of intelligence of Ukrainian are talking about he's going to resign. And at the same time, you're having that some disagreements, many disagreements, not some disagreement, between Zelensky and Syrsky. Do you think that it's going to collapse in Ukraine and the United States? How the United States can manage the situation in Ukraine? Is that possible? Or if gets out of the hand, it's out of the hand. They're not capable of doing anything.
Well, the concept of managing something implies that you're in control. And there's the ultimate statement of hubris. I can manage the collapse of Ukraine. That implies that I'm in control of what happens in Ukraine. We control nothing in Ukraine. Nothing. I mean, you know, we may think we control Zelensky, but we really don't. I mean, we could control him the way we controlled, you know, President Diem in Vietnam, have him killed. You know, but then what happens after that? Who replaces him? What power structures move in? We're not in control of that. We can't dictate that outcome. We don't know. Zelensky right now is the president of what? Nothing. He's not the president. And that's a growing concern, not just from around the world. What the decisions he's making right now, what's the constitutional basis of this? He's operating outside the constitution of Ukraine. There were no presidential elections. His term in office has gone away. And you see parliamentarians starting to question this. You know, why do we have this man here? Why is he continuing to be president when he's not? We need to have an election. We need to come up with some sort of process that is constitutional in nature for this, you know, this leadership. And you see the lack of trust and confidence in the Zelensky regime is gone. Ministers are fleeing. One of the reasons is because they're so corrupt that you can't hide the corruption anymore. And so they've literally taken the money we've given them. They've already put it in bank accounts around that we helped put them in because we understand the game. Remember, we were giving the Afghan warlords literally suitcases full of money up until the very end. I mean, one of the most embarrassing stories is how the CIA delivered a whole bunch of money to a guy who ended up basically putting on a helicopter so fast that they were falling off and the dollars were being spread all over the place. But the CIA was delivering money to the warlords up until the very end. And we will continue delivering money to these corrupt people that we've empowered in Ukraine up until the very end. But they're not taking the money, just like the Afghans didn't take the money to die for this cause. When you're corrupt and you take money like that, that means you want to live. No corrupt official is going to be on the front line holding the weapon. I mean, you may not like Lukashenko, the president of Belarus, but I'll tell you what, when, you know, the people were in the streets after the, you know, so-called contested election and, you know, things were getting ugly, that guy got off a helicopter holding an automatic weapon saying, bring it on, you know, dying in the streets. Saddam Hussein didn't run. Saddam Hussein was willing to fight. In fact, he had to be physically put into a vehicle when Baghdad fell and taken out of Baghdad because he was getting ready to make a last stand in Adamiya. And his lieutenant said, no. We're going to get you up to Oujda and hide you around and see if we can, you know, ride this thing out. Didn't work out for him, but, you know, he didn't flee with all the gold and, you know, he was supposed to be the most corrupt individual in the world with all the gold and all the money and all this stuff. He didn't flee with that. He didn't run. Look at Ukraine. They're all running away. Look at look at Afghanistan. They all fled. How many Afghan leaders sat there and fought to the death when the Taliban came in? Did Karzai and company defend the palace to the death? Dig in, bring it on, let's do it. No, they ran with their money because they're corrupt. And that's eventually what's going to happen here is that the Zelensky cronies are going to run with their money. They've already put billions and billions around the world, hidden in real estate, hidden in banks, hidden in other investments. It's sickening that we support this kind of stuff, but that's the way it's going to be. But Zelensky is, he can't, there's nothing viable. Again, let's see what happens this winter. Because right now he continues to exist. I mean, he just got more money. So if you're corrupt and you're saying, well, as long as Zelensky's in power, we get our money. Well, they just got their money. But let's see how many of these people ride out the winter. Let's see how full the Ukrainian parliament is come spring of 2025. Let's see how many Ukrainian ministers are still in play. And I think you're going to start to see Ukrainian generals start to flee too. When the going gets tough, the corrupt get going, and they're going to be fleeing with their money. In the end, it's going to be a bunch of colonels on the front line with their soldiers looking around going, there's nothing left worth fighting for. And that's going to be it.
You talk about Olaf Scholz. Do you think that Germany is awakening and finally it can help the European Union?
I think Scholz is, again, this is a decision could have been made a long time ago. But he didn't do it because he gambled. Scholz, like the rest of Europe, gambled on sanctions actually causing the collapse of Russia, weakening Russia, Ukraine prevailing. Didn't happen. The sanctions backfired. He's now looking at election results and realizing that his party is gone. His coalition is finished. The Greens have no more credibility. The lefts are gone. I think it's a Socialist Democratic Party is finished. And so it's an act of desperation to maintain his viability as a leader. He has to address these issues. And so he will, we now see for the first time he's talking about an investigation into Nordstrom. Because how do you explain to the German people why you have zero growth? You are the strongest economy in Europe and you have zero growth and you're going to have a depression. Zero growth is optimistic. The reality is a collapse of the German economy. That's what's happening. You're the one in charge. How do you explain that? So I think he's going to call the Russians and say, we have to work something out, And the Russians are, I mean, what he thinks Russia is going to what, give up on Ukraine? I think Scholz understands Ukraine's a lost cause. And so I think he's going to try and make an effort to trade the resumption of energy engagement with Germany and by extension, at least Western Europe. I mean, the Eastern European states are lost, Poland, the Baltics, all this, but they can't survive in isolation. They're nothing without the being propped up by the rest Western Europe. But Scholz is getting ready to jump ship. He has no choice. And so I think he's looking for a compromise solution where he can trade the resumption of energy for some sort of settlement in Ukraine. And you hear a lot of talk about this right now that Ukraine is being pressured to permanently give up territory, meaning that there would be a treaty-based arrangement with Russia that permanently gives Russia the territories that are now that Russia claims are it. But in exchange, Ukraine gets to join NATO. Russia will never go with that. I think it's beyond that. These are things that could have been talked about earlier, but I think you're looking at the total collapse. Russia didn't invest all this time and effort into bringing down Ukraine just to throw it all away at the end because Olaf Scholz is in a political bind. There's a deal there to be made. The question is how desperate Europe is at the time that that deal is still on the table. Because the longer you wait and the more certain decisive Russian victory becomes, the less likely it is that Russia is going to want to be seen as giving away that which it doesn't need to give, and asking for Ukrainian membership for NATO, Russia will never go with it. It'll never happen. The best you're going to get is neutrality, and hope that Russia is kind enough to leave enough of Ukraine, physically intact that you can Ukraine has economic viability. Dnipropetrovsk, Odessa, Kharkov, Sumy, Mykolaiv. These are territories that Russia could easily justify absorbing, given what Sumy should never be Ukraine again because it was used as a launching pad into Kursk. Kharkov should never be Ukraine again because it was used as launching pad into Belgorod. Odessa is used to attack Crimea. Russia has every right to say you've lost these territories in perpetuity. They will become part of Russia and insist on that being part of a final peace deal. Maybe Germany can come in and negotiate something that says, we'll lift the sanctions, we'll get you back into the energy business in Europe, but you have to be satisfied with the territory. And look at Putin. He said, we're not in it for territorial acquisition. So there's a compromise out there waiting to be had. Let's see if Germany has the ability to pull this off. But right now, Germany is desperate. But Europe is not far behind. I mean, what's happening to Germany is going to happen to the rest of Europe.
You've mentioned how important is this communication between Europeans and Russia. We know how the security treaty between Russia and Europe is crucial, is important for the future of Ukraine, for the future of Russia, the relationship between Europe and Russia. And how do you see right now in terms of what we're witnessing in the United Kingdom and the sort of animosity that they're having toward Russia? Is that possible to have a new treaty, a security treaty between Russia and the European Union?
Well, I think you have a failed assumption here. Russia has no interest in being a partner with Europe anymore. Europe can't be trusted. Europe brings nothing to the table in its current configuration. Ukraine has no future. That's the other thing you have to understand. Don't stop talking about the future of Ukraine. Ukraine has no future. It lost a war. That's the reality. Ukraine has lost this war. Ukraine doesn't get to function as a meaningful actor. That's Zelensky's fantasy, that the world revolves around Ukraine, that Ukraine will have a seat at the table, that because Ukraine was the shield that protected Europe from Russia, Ukraine now has, Ukraine is defeated, a defeated nation that'll, sink back into the pathetic, world that it deserves to occupy as long as you have Ukrainian nationals. I've been reading up. I mean, you go back and you take a look at Yatsenko and Yats and the first prime minister and the things he talked about. He called Russians subhuman, and he empowered people that talked about how the Donbass was overpopulated with a certain element that had to be, basically eliminated. He said that eliminated about a third. He's talking about Russian speakers. And so you have a Ukrainian government that after 2014 was actively engaged conceptually and in action with the genocide of Russian speakers. And you want me to have sympathy for these people? You want me to sit there and say, no, show them mercy? You can't. And this is why Russia, when Russia speaks about denazification, we in the West tend to point at that and say, well, come on, Nazism really died in 1945 with Adolf Hitler. But it didn't. The Banderist ideology, which has been promoted and promulgated by the United States. Again, I point to Ellenville, New York, right down the road, where they have four statues, including the Stepan Bandera and Roman Shushkevich, mass murderers, disgusting human beings, pigs. They're called heroes. And there's a children's camp. Every year they send, Ukrainian American children there to be polluted with the minds of Banderism. They literally walk around with the Banderist flags and they sing songs to our father, Stepan Bandera. And that's what Ukraine is right now. It's a disgusting, seething mass of, Nazi derivative hate. And you want that to live? No, Ukraine has to die in its current manifestation. Whatever comes from Ukraine, we'll find out. But to sit here and claim that somehow we have to be concerned about the future of Ukraine, when Ukraine has been nothing but a cancer to Europe and Russia ever since the end of the Second World War. Again, study. One of these days, people will do the study. I don't know if I'll live long enough and have access to the documents, but study what happened when the Russians crushed the Ukrainian nationalist movement in the early to mid 1950s. A quarter of a million people fled, went into diaspora to Ellenville and other places, but the others were taken and put in the gulag. And then Khrushchev came and released them. and study how they came back and how they reinsinuated themselves into Ukrainian society with the help of the CIA. The CIA ran an active operation from 1948 up until 1990, the job of which was to insinuate the Banderists, the Nazis, into Ukrainian political structures, economic structures, social structures. And that's why you saw the ease. Remember, 2014 wasn't the first time that Ukrainian nationalism lifted its ugly head politically. I think the 2004-2005 election put in place a prime minister who turned around. One of his first actions was to make Stepan Bandera the national hero of Ukraine. So this is a disease that's infected Ukraine for some time now. And it has to be pulled out root and stem. It can't be allowed to exist. So let's stop talking about Ukraine and its current manifestation, that we have to somehow preserve it. No, it has to be done away with. And that's happening right now as we speak. So we can't be talking about Russia wanting that to happen. Anybody who says, well, we want to preserve Ukraine, Russia does not want to preserve Ukraine. That's what denazification is. And they're not going to allow Ukraine to be part of NATO. That's what demilitarization is. These are the two fundamental pillars of Russian policy towards Ukraine. And as long as the West insists on a Zelensky-style government or derivative government being in power in Ukraine, that hasn't denazified anything. And as long as they insist that NATO have some sort of role in Ukraine, that hasn't demilitarized. So these are artificial hopes. So we need to remove that. And Russia has been betrayed by Europe one too many times. So Russia's in no hurry to repair relations with the West. In fact, from their perspective, letting the West simmer in the juices of the stew it's created for itself might not be a bad thing. Because what, do you really want to engage with Emmanuel Macron? Russia doesn't want to engage with him. Why? He's the guy talking about sending French troops out there. He's a man who thinks that France is somehow relevant. Why not let France drop down a little bit? Germany sat there and literally almost put the swastika armbands back on as German tanks were in Kursk. That really, you want to deal with that, Jerry? Let the Germans simmer. And the same thing with the United Kingdom. If you think that Starmer's at the head of a healthy entity right now, you know, Keir Starmer, that he's somehow, there's a reason why Great Britain's had five prime ministers in 5 years, because they suck. Their whole situation sucks. He's not going to be able to put together a budget that can do anything, let alone live up to the naive glorification of somehow the resurgence of the British military leading Europe on a path to victory against Russia. Let the UK simmer a little bit. And as for America, a little bit different here, because Russia does need at some point in time to engage with us on strategic arms control. But we have to have America purged of the Russophobes, these Putin whisperers that have been in the ear of administration after administration after administration, have to be discredited. They have to be nullified politically. You have to purge academia. Georgetown University needs to fire 80% of its adjunct professors, all these former CIA and State Department people to go in there and breathe hatred to the next generation of American diplomats. Stanford needs to get rid of Michael McFaul and anything that touched Michael McFaul. Harvard needs to purge itself. So does Yale. Start training the next generation of, you know, Russian experts to be genuine Russian experts, never to turn their back on America and what America needs, what America wants, but to be realistic about how to deal with Russia, not looking for war, but looking for peace. Russia's in a position right now where they're winning. BRICS is a huge victory. They've resolved the issue of how to economically survive without the West, with their relations with India, with China, their growing relationship with Africa. Russia doesn't have to do anything right now. And I don't think Russia's in any rush to do anything. Russia will always leave the door open to discussions. They've never shut the door. But these discussions aren't going to be what the West thinks they're going to be. They're going to be a completely different agenda. And that agenda is going to have to be politically acceptable. And that's not going to happen with the current generation or the current iteration of political elites in Europe. Olaf Scholz will never be able to cut a deal with Vladimir Putin, because Vladimir Putin will never trust Olaf Scholz. Putin may trust the person that comes after Olaf Scholz. I don't think Vladimir Putin's ever going to trust Emmanuel Macron. He'll trust the person that comes after Emmanuel Macron. And the same thing with Keir Starmer. Won't even begin to talk to them. Maybe somebody after, people who are genuinely sincere about working out a deal, as opposed to how sincere can you be when you're desperate to save yourself from a ship, sinking ship? You'll say anything to get off that sinking ship. I think the Russians are going to let that ship sink and wait for the next crew to come in. So that's just my take. Again, I can't speak for Russia. The Russians have to look at, their own situation. But I think BRICS is a huge empowering vehicle for Russia, and they're in no hurry to help Europe get out of the mess that they've made. Russia's paid too heavy of a price. I just want to remind people that Russia's lost, even though the Russians haven't admitted this. My calculations are they lost over 100,000 dead. You don't lose 100,000 dead and just say nothing. And remember, Russia doesn't blame Ukraine on this. This is a war against NATO and the collective West. Russia blames the West for these dead, as they should. So I don't think Russia's in any hurry to make good with the West. Russia doesn't need to. It's the West that needs to make good with Russia. So Russia will pick the time and place when it's time to go in that direction. But the terms I think Russia will set, they'll be fair, but they'll be harsh. They'll be fair, but they'll be harsh.